Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And welcome to fall, everyone. We've officially hit the first day of fall. It's a little weird. I can't be the only person who's feeling the seasonal affective disorder already creeping in. I can't be the only one. Is anybody else out there feeling that? You wake up in the morning, it's a little cooler. Staying in bed feels a lot better. And it just seems like everything would be so much better if you could just stay in bed and let the world take care of itself. But you can't. Or if you're me, you can't. And you hit the snooze button far too many times, you roll out of bed at 5 a.m., and you take care of yourself. You go to work. That's just how it is. And it's been catching up to me. So, I've decided that I've got to make some changes if I want to feel better. I'll give you an example. This morning, I wasn't feeling great. And I mean like emotionally, mentally. I wasn't feeling all that healthy. I could feel the disconnect. I could feel the scattered thoughts. I could feel the tendrils of suicidal ideation coming at me. I could feel all of that, readily aware of it. And now here I am, more than 12 hours later, and I don't feel that anymore. I can't touch that anymore. And I know it'll be back for me. It always is. And that's fine. I got a toolbox. And I can make it to the next day. But I also know that there are some things that can make things worse. And some things that can make things better. And I've been doing way too many of the things that make things worse lately. Does that have anything to do with how I woke up this morning? I bet you it does. So, I've decided that I've been relying on having a glass of wine or, a couple of fingers of whiskey to get me to sleep at night. And that's problematic. What started as something that I loved, something that I could do that would make me happy and make me feel good, turned into a utility just to help me sleep. It's no good. It's not healthy behavior. So it's time to cut it out for a little while. See if that changes anything. It's also time to exercise a little more. Have I been exercising every day already? Yes. But you know, I could get the heart rate up a little. Maybe do some weightlifting. Who knows? Maybe even kick out on the skateboard. Falling down hurts when you're this age. But, man, you know what feels good? Moving. Getting out there and moving. Not everything feels good forever. Not everything is fun forever. So you know what? Sometimes you set some stuff aside, you take a break, and you come back later. And that's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to let you know whether or not this affects me. You know, I was just talking in the last episode about how do you know when you're done with your therapist? How do you know when it's time to get somebody new? I'm not entirely certain that it's time for me. But I'm going to pay attention to it. Because it matters. Now, you know what else matters? Today on the show, we have a first-time podcast guest. That's right. This person has never been on a podcast before in her life. And she was one of the greatest guests that I've had. We have a wonderful conversation. She's funny. She's insightful. And I'm just going to let her tell you who she is. Ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to my conversation with Julie Goodall. Great. Well, first things first, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am great. I decided to sleep in a little bit today.
Good for you.
Which, yeah, I absolutely needed because it's been pretty intense lately. My schedule has been sort of nuts, and it's made sleeping difficult. And sleep is really important.
That it is.
Where are you at right now?
I am in South Burlington, Vermont.
Nice. So it's already afternoon by you.
It is. It is 1:06 p.m.
Hey, good afternoon then.
Thank you. Yeah. So I've shut off the coffee for the day. I'm adequately caffeinated and ready to go.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about Vermont. Is that where you're from?
It is. Yeah. Born and raised in a little town called Georgia, Vermont, which every time I say Georgia, people assume the state, and I always have to clarify.
Yeah.
Georgia is about 30 minutes from the Canadian border. We can do Montreal in about an hour and a half.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know, we can still do, you know, Boston and New York City, you know, 3 hours and 5 hours respectively. So, you know, there's not a ton to do here as far as city life stuff goes. So some folks, you know, it's not for everybody. But it is the Green Mountain State. And so if you like to hike or ski or snowboard, this is the place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Nature is something that, you know, that's, I guess that's why I love living in Denver so much is that it sort of has all the big city stuff when I want it, but, but there's so much nature and there's mountains everywhere and it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, Denver's on my bucket list of places to check out.
Well, when you come out, I'll take you for a burrito. It'll be a good time.
Awesome. Awesome.
So what was growing up like? What kind of kid were you?
Oh, you know, I was the kid that was already an adult.
Yeah?
I think partly situationally. My mom worked a ton as a kid, or when I was a kid, not when she was a kid. She worked a lot. And so I don't know, I guess it's just natural for me. I try to compensate. I'm a people pleaser and a helper. So, you know, I remember being 7, 8, 9 years old and always trying to tidy up the house and rearrange furniture and mop the floors. We have a photo of me at age 5 with a broken leg and a mop. And people used to pick on my parents, you know, because it looked really bad. It was like, look, she's broken and she's still cleaning the house.
Yeah.
So I guess you can say clumsy. clumsy and, you know, always just trying to help out and try to make other people's lives easier, which is, you know, still a thing.
Yeah.
30 years later, 38 years later. So, but Vermont is a great place to grow up. You know, it's super safe. You know, there's like, I don't want to say there's no crime, but I think in the grand scheme of things, people would say there's no crime here.
Right.
I have a cousin from Virginia and we were watching the news one time and he was just like, what is this? Like, there's cows on the news. And I'm like, yeah, what do you guys talk about? And, you know, he was telling me about delivering ice for a company when he was in his late teens and, you know, he had a gun pulled on him or something. And I was just horrified that's a thing in places, you know?
Yeah. So. It's a little hard for me to wrap my head around sometimes. I do think about my history because I was born in Michigan and that's where I spent a good deal of my life. And Michigan is kind of all over the place as far as beautiful nature and dangerous cities.
Because Detroit's pretty rough, right?
Yeah, Detroit is scary. The city I was living in was called Saginaw. We had like 22% unemployment. It was pretty intense. And I think about the things I went through, especially as a person who's generally pretty fearful, I think. You know, the times that I've had to, chase crackheads out of my house. Literally out of my house.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. And the times that I've, had a gun in my face, and I was like, you know, I'm familiar enough with seeing people with guns that I'm like, that's not a real gun.
Wow.
You know? And so it was those kinds of things that, you know, I moved here where people generally are pretty friendly, and they, you know, they talk to each other and things like that. And it kind of took a while to adjust to that sort of thing. I didn't realize exactly how much kind of day-to-day PTSD and fear that I had that was just based around life.
Yeah, that's intense. Yeah. I mean, there's guns in Vermont, but the thing is, Vermont's a big hunting state.
Sure.
So everybody has guns. I mean, I grew up with that too. You know, I mean, there's people that have, you know, gun cases. It's a decorative item in their houses here.
Right. Yeah.
But they're rifles and they're for, you know, killing animals,
right,
you know, in the right season, and then they freeze them and they eat them, and you know, that's,
yeah,
but that's it. It's so weird that, yeah, I never really understood why, and to each their own, but you know, why people choose to live in a place where they can't go out, or they are fearful, you know, going from home to work. Like, yeah. I couldn't imagine living like that.
It's kind of a strange.
The perks must outweigh that.
No.
I imagine.
No. No.
Okay.
It's just how life is. I mean, you kind of get yourself into a certain situation and you just sort of recognize it and you compensate for it. It's like any other sort of mental condition that you find yourself in. You'll find coping mechanisms and compensations. Whether they're healthy or not is another story. But, you know, I would run in my neighborhood, and I knew, you know, which blocks were okay and which blocks were not, but it was a block by block basis. And that was just a way of life. And I think about that now, and that sounds crazy. Someone got shot two blocks away. Well, that's foreign policy. That's two blocks.
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, and here I am, like, I get all hurt and offended when people on the street don't just, you know, make eye contact and smile and say good morning, because that's offensive here, you know?
Yeah, but I've adjusted to that, too. I mean, that's my reality now. When someone is standoffish, my first thought isn't, you know, to get ready, because they could throw a punch. It's to go, I wonder what happened to their day.
They didn't get their coffee this morning or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of nuts. It's good to grow up in a situation like that. I would have to imagine that your stories of things that went awry are probably pretty quaint to some people.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, the irony is, when I was 18, I couldn't wait to get out of the state.
Yeah.
And I know that's the norm, because obviously I have lots of friends and family from here. And it seems to be that kind of teenager age where you're just like, this state is boring and I'm going to go to New York and make it big. I'm going to go here. I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
And then you visit those places. And if you're from here, you're just like, good Lord, no, no. You know, and you come back, and I still went through, it was probably, I bet you I had a good 5-year stretch where I lived here, but begrudgingly, you know, I lived here, but it was like, oh, but only until I can afford to leave. And then it wasn't until I had kids that I truly appreciated Vermont for what it is. It's like, okay, now I live on a dead end street. You know, my oldest can walk and meet her friends a couple houses down. They can walk around the blocks. You know, they're all interconnected until dark. And I don't even after dark, I would just assume they're playing flashlight tag. Like, that's how safe it is.
Yeah.
And I also have a toddler who can, you know, toddle around, I mean, really down the street, and nobody's going to go over 5 miles an hour in this neighborhood. And so
right.
I appreciate that so much more now. I understand now the value of that, but I didn't for a really long time. You know, you sort of take it for granted when you're born in that situation. And so...
Yeah,
now I'll probably never leave.
Well, and there's a level of you know, everybody goes through their various things, and mm-hmm. and you know, the thing that I always say to people is, you know, what is the worst kind of pain and anguish? Yours.
it doesn't
matter. It doesn't matter if, you know, things are comparatively better. In a certain way, you kind of can't qualify pain and harm to people. Mm-hmm. It just sort of is what it is when it's your experience.
Yeah.
And so there is a way to, let's say, put yourself in a better situation. But when you have... when you have any kind of thing like for instance, like I have bipolar, and so mm-hmm. for me, when I was in a really bad situation, there were things setting off the alarm bells all the time. Yeah. And when I moved to a better situation, it made things better, but it didn't make the problems go away.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they're still going to be there. They might be different problems. They might take different shapes, but there will always be problems, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And triggers.
And I know that you've had some experience with loss mm-hmm. and people in your life. What can you tell me about that?
So I've lost numerous friends to suicide, and I've actually... I didn't save them, but I've kept a few more who, you know, were kind of on the fence and really struggling. I mean, I spent a couple nights up all night on the phone with people. And I think, you know, I think like attracts like, and that's kind of sad, but there was a point in my life, several actually, where it was an option for me, or maybe it wasn't going to, you know, go all the way, but the thought had crossed my mind and for a while on a daily basis. Like, it's just, mental health is a really hard thing. And I spent a really long time trying to figure out what in my situation needed to change to make that go away. You know, I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that a lot of mental health, it's chemical, you know what I mean? So it doesn't matter what you do. Like you said, you can move, you can eliminate people and things from your life, but if chemically you're still so off, you know, it's still there. And so I've always been really open about that. And so I think what that does is it opens the door for other people, you know, when they know that you've struggled and you're so open about it, that they feel like it's a safe space for them to talk about. And so I've had, I would say probably more than a lot of people, you know, people turn to me and be really kind of in their darkest hour. And you know, the couple that I wasn't able to help, it's really hard to remember that it's not your fault.
Yeah.
You know, like there's that, I guess I have I have a martyr complex. And so I should have saved them. You know, I should have checked in more. I should have been there. I should have sent an email, a text, a phone call, you know, but I was busy, and then spend hours beating myself up about, like, you're too busy to save someone's life, you know, but then that implies a lot of power that I don't have, you know what I mean? Like, truth be told, I don't have that power.
Right.
It's their choice, just like it was my choice. And so I spend a lot of time really trying to, and I think similar, obviously, to the reason for your podcast, but to try to make it not taboo, you know, to bring it up to, I have, I'm sure you're familiar, but Project Semicolon, I have a semicolon on my wrist.
Yeah.
And it starts a lot of conversations, you know, and people ask me what it means, and I say it, and they just, the look on their face that I'm just so openly talking about it is, you know, it's good and bad. It just makes me realize how many people don't.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of the problem with any mental health stuff, you know, whether it's depression, anxiety, bipolar, like anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard when people feel like they can't open up about it. Like, the worst feeling in the world, you're already so isolated. You're already so, you know, there's shame and guilt and all these feelings. And, you know, how awful to not be able to share that and unload, you know, unpack with somebody.
Yeah. In a way, it's almost like being left-handed. I mean, it's just an alternate way of being. And there are ways that you can mitigate that. And there are ways around it, but ultimately being able to have conversations with people about it and eliminating that, that stigma and that shame, that mm-hmm. that self-loathing, it can go a long way toward creating a better circumstance for you to be able to deal with.
Yeah. And it's hard now. I think I struggle more now, not personally, but with the issue in general, because my oldest is 13 and the amount of kids that are impacted that feel this way, that I can't even explain the fact that they're 13 and they want to end it.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
How awful. I mean, I just, I can't say, you know, what could be so awful in your life at 13? You know what I mean?
Like, right.
You don't have debt and bills and a job that you hate. And there's like, trust me, when you're older, it'll suck worse. I promise.
Yeah.
You know? but you can't say that because I remember feeling that way. And I have to remember that it's not a situational thing. It doesn't have to be a thing that's causing the suck,
yeah.
You know?
But yeah. It
breaks
could be
my heart
wiring.
That exactly.
And that's the thing, being able to have a conversation with somebody, especially being able to talk to your parents, because at that point,
yes.
You know, they're in charge of your health insurance and your yeah. ability to get someone, you know, maybe a therapist with some coping mechanisms or things like that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
if your parents are not open to something like that, at that age, you're kind of screwed. It's
right.
It's a rough situation to find yourself in if you can't get the help that you need.
Yeah.
I remember being very young.
Me too.
So how old were you when you first discovered that kind of, you know, darkness in you?
So I'm working backwards a little bit. I was put on medication for depression and anxiety at 16, but only because I had struggled with it for years at that point.
Yeah.
And 16 was really the age, kind of like you said, where it was in my hands. I had a vehicle. I had, you know, I could make my own decisions and I could take myself to the doctor and kind of figure out what I wanted to do. But I had resisted it for probably 3 years prior
mm-hmm.
because of the stigma.
Yes.
Because I'm like, I don't want to be the only kid in my school on medication. Medication's for old people, you know, people who need it for cholesterol and,
yeah,
and all
totally.
Those things. Like, I'm 13. I don't need medication. I'm not sick or broken. And you know, and it's unfortunate that I felt that way, because when you're that age and you're to some extent powerless, right? Like you can't go to the doctors, you can't, and you don't know enough about what's good and what's bad as far as outlets go. You end up kind of self-medicating in other ways.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think there's obviously a big correlation with mental health. Any kind of mental health issues and, like, obviously drug and alcohol abuse and things like that.
Yep.
And before all of that, because, you know, thankfully in Vermont at age 13, drugs and alcohol weren't really a big thing in my life. I didn't know people, you know, that were doing anything like that.
Right.
But what I did have control over at that point was what I put in my body. And so a lot of my depression at that time was tied to, image, you know, comparing, because at 13, you know, girls especially were starting to check out the magazines and figure out what we were quote unquote should look like.
Right.
And I was a pretty chunky kid. I used to joke that I was as round as I was tall when I was, you know, 11, 12. And so my first sort of way to cope and way to control my situation was eating disorders.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's a really young age. I suspect it's probably fairly common. But again, there's a stigma, so nobody actually talks about it.
Right.
You know, so when I hated myself, I would punish myself. I would deprive myself of food. You know, that was my, you know, you're fat and therefore ugly and worthless and all of these other things that go along with that. And so you don't get to eat today.
Yeah.
Like that was my, you know, and as an adult, I can see that, wow, that's some pretty fucked up thinking.
Oh, yeah.
And
I still do that sometimes now.
Oh, me too. Different levels, different, you know.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but I think as an adult now, if it were my daughter, because I have both girls, medication would have helped with that, I think, a little bit. It would have regulated me a little bit. You know, the highs wouldn't have been as high, the lows wouldn't have been as low. But I did some pretty nasty damage to my body early on because
yeah.
I didn't know any better. I didn't know that those things were going to last, you know?
Yeah.
I simply thought you don't eat, you get skinny. Then I feel better. because I'm worth more and more attractive, and I'm better member of society if I'm, you know, a normal weight or size.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if all of these things could be controlled with just math?
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. Addition and subtraction isn't the entirety of the solve on this Rubik's Cube. There's all these metaphysical pieces that just refuse to be moved by equations.
Yep. So, you know, to answer your original question, you know, I would say as early as 11, you know, started feeling things that in hindsight I can see were depression or anxiety or probably both. And that went on for years, and I handled it in my own very poor way. And then when I was 16, I started on medications for the first time. And, you know, that was a really rough road too. As much as it was right and it was necessary. I don't know, you know, your history or anything, but I had to try a lot of different drugs to get one that worked with my system. And tell you what, like, that sucked in its own way too. I mean, I had some that were making me pass out, that were making me weak, that gave me horrible nightmares. I mean, they talk about side effects like dry mouth. This was like, I would have violent dreams. And it always kills me that on the side of any depression or anxiety med, it, you know, it may cause suicidal thoughts. It's like, well, right. That'll help. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I have definitely went through a few rounds, trying to figure out the right cocktail. They put me on some really strong stuff, at first, and then we had to go milder, and it was kind of all over the place. But that was still sort of, I mean, thinking about it now, it almost feels like it was the Wild West, because they were throwing all kinds of things at people and going, well, let's give it a month and see what happens. And if it's not working, we'll try something else. Meanwhile, in that month, you're experiencing all of the side effects before any of the benefits, and everything is in complete chaos. And now, talking to a therapist for and getting medication for the first time in 15 years, it has changed so much. Everything has changed so much.
Yeah.
And we have a way better system now.
But back then it was, and sometimes they wouldn't wait, and they would, you know, or they'd be like, well, just stay on it for 6 weeks. And I'm like, you don't understand.
Yeah.
That this is almost not manageable. Like, I was bad before, but now I'm on, you know, day 4, 5, 6 of no sleep, and I can't keep anything down.
Oh, my God, yes.
You know, like, it was awful. And then, you know, finally found one that worked, and, you know, of course, medication is not the end-all be-all, so I was really good, and I did different therapists and stuff, and I did that for a long time before I found a good one. I didn't realize at the time there was a difference between a therapist and a good therapist.
Yeah.
So I was seeing people because I was supposed to.
Yeah.
But I never felt better. And I didn't really get any coping mechanisms or really anything out of it other than maybe at best an hour vent session.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there's value in. But really only for that day. After that, it you're still dealing with the same shit. And
yeah. You need somebody to be a check on yourself. If you're not managing things correctly, you need somebody to come in at least with a toolbox and say, you know, here's a few things. See if this hammer, this wrench, or this screwdriver work for you.
Right.
Otherwise, what are you doing?
Yes. And there was a point, I still laugh about this. There was a point I had kind of gone through some therapists, and I wasn't, you know, giving them like one shot. I would spend a couple of months and I would just be like, well, this just really isn't working for me. But there was a point, I think I was on my third or fourth therapist, and every one of them gave me, I used to joke, so I don't have a college degree. Mm-hmm. For a number of reasons, but mainly because I love to take classes that interest me. So I have a ton of credits.
Right.
They just don't equal a formal degree.
Right.
And I'm okay with that now, but I struggled with that for a long time. And so I used to joke that I when I grew up,
yeah.
I wanted the acronyms after my name. I wanted to be, you know, PhD or have a master's or a BA. Like, I just wanted something. And then in the height of my depression and anxiety, I finally got those acronyms. They just weren't the ones that I wanted. So at one point I was like, so you're telling me I am ADD, OCD. They had given me all of these things. And I was like, wow, I finally got those acronyms. Like, yeah, I've arrived, you know? But it was like every therapist I met diagnosed me with some new and exciting. Oh, I was bipolar for a while. Mm-hmm. And then there was, dissociative identity disorder or something like that. I mean, I had so many. Yeah. And I was like, this is insane. Because there was a point where it depressed me because I was like, oh my God, I am super fucked up. I knew right. I was fucked up, but I am super fucked up with a cape.
Right.
And then, I was like, wait a minute. There's no way I have all of these things. And I realized, and I think it's, again, along the same lines of like, let's just prescribe people everything and hope something sticks, that I think these medical professionals were just sort of tagging me with whatever, like, somehow the diagnosis was going to help something. You know, like, we just have to give you something. We have to call you something. Let's call you ADD. Let's right. call you OCD. Let's call you... And I remember one of them, she would be like, well, do you do this? Do you do this? Do you do this? And I was like, yeah, sometimes. And she almost jumped out of her chair in excitement. She's like, and I forget what it was. It was another acronym. And I was like, does this excite you? Like, are you happy about this? Because this is terrible news for me. Like,
yeah.
And I got to a place where I checked myself into, it wasn't an inpatient. It was voluntary, but it was a few hours, 5 days a week. It was kind of an intensive, like, hey, I really can't do this by myself anymore. I'm not in a place where biweekly therapy sessions for 50 minutes are really doing the job, and I need some help, or stuff's going to go south real fast.
Yeah.
And so I joined this group, and it was amazing. It was a great group, and I made a very good friend in that group. But when they were asking, you sort of go around almost like an Al-Anon type, 12-step program where, you go in and you say your name, and I used all of my acronyms. They just kind of looked at me and I was like, yeah, I don't know what I am. I don't know what my issue is. Depends on who you ask. It's just, it's comical now, but at the time I was so low. But I believed everything they said also because I had no self-esteem.
Right.
And no, I had no identity anymore. I didn't know
they're
who
experts.
Or what I was.
You're supposed to be able to trust them.
Yes.
And I think for the most part, there is a level of trust that has to go along with that. But if you're, mm-hmm. but if you are a person with low self-esteem and you have doubt in yourself, you don't know when someone is telling you something that inside, in your gut, you know it doesn't feel quite right. But you don't really feel like you have the authority to speak up for yourself.
Right. Well, because they must know better. And that's been something that's been woven throughout my life since childhood. I always, and to this day, this is one of those things I haven't been able to shake yet. I always assume that, some people assume they're the smartest person in every room.
Yeah.
I have the opposite. No matter who I'm talking to, I'm certain they know more than I do.
Right.
And obviously, like, I've learned it's not the case. And it not only is it not always the case, but it's often not the case, and not that I'm the smartest, but like when I work with my clients and stuff, they're paying for my expertise. And so I don't know why I go into the meeting going, oh, they're going to think I'm stupid. They're not going to hire me, and then I go in and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. Everybody else we've talked to hasn't been able to figure this out. And in that moment, I'm like, okay, remember this moment. See, it's not always you but I do it. I do it on the daily. It's, so especially when they do have the acronym, the right one, I do assume that they know more than I do. And I assume there's a reason. And as I age, I'm getting better. Like, age has helped a lot.
Yeah.
But it's hard.
Yeah.
Life is hard. It just is,
So when you're going through all of this, I mean, you brought up several things, and I think that I think it's fascinating that you're going through all of these things. As a young girl whose standards are being laid out, en masse everywhere, and so not only do you have those external pressures, but you've got these other internal pressures where it's like, maybe the chemicals aren't firing the way that they're supposed to on top of all of that. And so what are the, I'm curious what the attitudes of the, let's just say even the people around you, about these topics, like first off, what were you learning just from observation about what would be acceptable for you to feel and talk about?
Yeah, so I think my parents are much, well, yeah, they're much older than me. I'm sure that surprises you. they were older when they had me. So they're also of a completely different generation and of the generation where you really don't talk about that stuff. You know, for the longest time, you know, even therapy or any of that, it was really just taboo. And it wasn't, it's certainly not their fault. It was just the time, you know, that's private stuff. You don't air those things. And I think part of that is why I wasn't open with it. And then, I mean, I wasn't for a long time. I don't think my parents knew about my eating disorders until I was in my 30s.
Wow.
Because I remember mentioning it offhand, because I just thought that at least, maybe not at the time, but since then they had picked it up, and they really didn't. Because I remember my mom being shocked, and I think it was about the time I was going for some stomach issues, some medical issues, and it turns out it was a result of years and years of laxative abuse from those days.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, well, I guess I can't say anything. This is self-inflicted. And we kind of went into it, and she was just genuinely shocked. So it certainly wasn't a matter of like people not being supportive or wanting to help me when I was going through it. I think I was better at hiding it than I thought I was.
But you were hiding it based on how you thought people would react.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was embarrassed. You know, as much as it felt right, like the not eating, because I did lose weight. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard because it serves its purpose. You know, if it didn't work, it would be like, well, I guess that didn't work. But it was like, no, I'm actually getting thin.
Right.
Like I'm getting the desired results here. So it wasn't until much, much later. And I am fortunate enough that I've been really just surrounded by amazing people. But to this day, still my best friend, there was a point where she was like, you need to check yourself in. Like, she wanted me to go inpatient. She's like, you're not well. You can't do this. Like, I don't care about your job or your family or anybody. You've got to do this for you. I need you here. I need you around. And she is forceful in such a loving way. Like, I haven't mastered that myself. She was basically telling me I didn't have a choice, but I didn't feel, you know, bullied or anything. And then I think it was in those groups that I realized how many people have those issues, you know, and they don't talk about them. But to meet people in a group that are outwardly successful, you know, they're successful in their professions, they've got families and lovely homes and cars. And it's like, oh, so this is a thing. This is not like a, you know, I'm a loser. I'm the minority of the population. This is like, no, if I saw these people on the street, I would envy them. I would think that they just have their stuff together.
Yeah.
And then I got into, you know, a field that involved viewing other people's, you know, financials and medical records and those things. And it was almost, it became odd to go through somebody's records and not find that they were on a medication or being seen for therapy or something. And then it was like, oh, this really is a thing. Like, this is a common thing. And so once I realized that, and I don't know if it had anything to do with me. I think the third or fourth friend, and some of them weren't really close friends, but still, people that I knew in my life, I knew them, I considered them a friend. When they lost their life, when they took their own lives, it became enough is enough. You know, because some of them, there was one or two that I didn't know struggled.
Yeah, no, completely.
You know, they never said a word. And it broke my heart because it's like, I would have been there. Like, if anybody understands, I understand, you know? And I've sat with people and I will tell them, like, if you don't want to talk about it, I get it. I just don't want you to be alone right now. Like, if you need to do something else, if you want to ignore me, I just don't want you to feel alone.
Yeah.
And I wish somebody had done that for me. You know, like, I'm grateful and I thank God every day that I am still here because I didn't have that. Nobody sat with me in my darkest hour and got me through. I don't know why I didn't ever do it. I just didn't. And I'm glad I didn't, but to know that people are struggling totally alone.
Yeah.
It just, it became
completely. I feel that even when I see strangers like that have committed suicide, you know, especially young kids and things like that, because I know what that feels like. And so it definitely has an effect on me when I see it. And I've wanted to be the kind of person that can say, you know what, if you're out there, you can talk to me about this. I'm up. I'm available. Because I've gone through it. I've gone through it the same way. The reaction that I would get from people, and I completely understand their reaction, was when I was struggling with this kind of stuff. The reaction I got from the people that I shared it with was, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
And, you know, not super helpful, but at the same time, I recognized the way they would say it, they were afraid. Like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to help you, and I don't know why you're like this, but goddammit, just stop. Just knock it off.
Just stop. Yep. And it's absolutely fear-based, and that's what I was thinking, too, is it because they get this, like, if you tell me, and then I don't do the right thing or anything, and then you do something, it's on me. Like, for the love of God, don't talk to me. Go talk to somebody else. Get help. Go talk to your doctor. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
The doctor is never going to be the right one. Not because they're not wonderful people and great doctors. But I mean, what am I going to do? Book it 3 weeks in advance? Hey, I think I'm going to have a meltdown 2 weeks from Wednesday. Do you have time at 9? Like, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? And so you sort of, you lean on who's there if you have to. And you just hope to God that they're going to be, I don't know, present, I guess, for you. And for me, it was always, I just need to talk. And I still do this, and I do this to my husband now. And I'll always preface it with, this is one of those conversations that you don't actually have to participate in. Like, I need a brain dump, and I just need to do it to a live body.
Yeah.
So just smile and nod every few minutes, and you're golden. Like, I don't expect you to retain any of it. I don't expect you to offer helpful advice. I just need to kind of get it out of my system. And he's great like that, you know?
Awesome.
And that's kind of all I've ever really needed. Is depression is isolating. Like, that is the number one thing that comes to mind when I think about it, is I just, you get in that space where you're like, I feel this thing, and nobody else would understand. Nobody understands. Nobody knows what it feels like. You know, it's like you said in the beginning of the conversation about, like, your pain is the worst pain. It's like, nobody understands my pain. Nobody has gone through this. Nobody. And the reality is, it's got to be like, what, 60% of the population has one form of, you know, depression, anxiety, something. It's like, but people still, they don't talk about it a lot. And
right.
So,
and I think the big reason behind that is because people do try to qualify their situation. They do try to compare it to another and say, you know what, I have things better than somebody else. And so I should probably just keep my mouth shut. It's like, no, you should probably just talk about it. Because even if you do have things better than everyone else, you know, it that doesn't matter. Because here's the thing. It's like, if you've got depression, if you've got anxiety, you can't buy a fix. It doesn't matter how much money you have. So money's not the problem. It doesn't matter how much status you have. It doesn't matter how many friends you have. It doesn't matter if you're skinny. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
None of that matters. If you are feeling this way, none of that shit is going to fix it. None of it.
No, and it's funny because that's the go-to, like, at least for me, and I'm not going to pretend I'm alone in this, but whenever I was really down, I would guilt myself. I'd be like, for the love of God, Julie, you've got a beautiful home, you've got two healthy kids, you've got a husband, you've got a great job. And I would sit there and I would list all the good things, and it only made me feel like shit.
Right.
It's like, so I am just a spoiled little brat who apparently is never going to be happy. Like, that's what it made me feel like, you know? It's like, you have all these things and you're still depressed. What is wrong with you? Will you never be happy? Like, and it just, that doesn't help. And I remember the first day that I met my friend at this, we affectionately call it Crazy Camp. It's nice. Obviously not the name.
Yeah.
We call it Crazy Camp because that's the way we talk about things now. Like, we're just totally cool with it. And so I met her at Crazy Camp, and we were all sitting down giving our stories. And that was my first thought, is I went in there And it, again, in my mind, there's really nothing wrong with me. Like, I feel these things, but there's nothing wrong with me. And she was in there, and her mom had cancer, and she had been recently divorced, and her kid was sick. Like, she just had all of these things. Like, if you could have just ticked them off, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I left there going, I don't belong here. Like, these people have real issues. They have loved ones who are terminal. They have people, you know, lost their homes in a fire, like all of these tragedies. And again, here I am, you know, with no problem in the world. And I am just, and it made me feel so bad. And she was one of those people that, again, kind of affectionately yelled at me. She's like, you don't get to decide who has it worse. Like, right. Who are you to decide? And I was like, okay, you're right. You know, but it's funny what we do. It's funny how we justify things and how, you know, there's some arbitrary limit as to, you know, who's got it worse or who, you know, who is allowed to feel these things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird form of tribalism sometimes.
Yes.
Like, you know, well, you know, us in this camp who are having real PTSD.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
You don't get to say you have PTSD because it's only right. reserved for this and, you know, all of that. It's kind of weird. You know, human beings love to separate ourselves into tribes.
Yeah. And PTSD was one of the acronyms I hadn't received yet. So I didn't get to claim that one.
Well, there's still time.
I mean, I got it after then. Don't worry. Oh, okay. I've gotten it since then. So I'm cool. Now I have PTSD also.
Great. Now return your bingo card to the front of the line and collect your prize.
I win. You know, and that's the funny thing too, is like people either have it significantly worse than me, in which case I don't envy them, but it's like they get to feel this way because they have it worse. Or I see people and I make the judgment call that they have their stuff together. They have a good life and they're better than me. It's like people, but for some reason, both is better than where I'm at. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
I'm not as good as the wealthy people who drive the nice car and have the beautiful home and they have all this money in the bank. But then there's these people who are really struggling and I'm not as good as them either. Cause I'm like, oh, look at them. Like they're just plugging along. They're doing their thing. Good for you. Good for you. And then I'm just here in the middle, like, and you suck. Because you're not bad and you're not good. You're just here, you know? Yeah. So you can't win.
Yeah.
You can't win.
So when did you first start getting some coping mechanisms that were actually helping you move forward?
Chris, did I imply that I had those coping mechanisms that actually... No. I think I developed some by accident. So I don't like to be told what to do. So as much as people would tell me exercise is a great one,
yeah.
I'd be like, I don't want to exercise. You can't tell me to exercise. Like, you know, going for a walk is not going to make me feel better. But I took up running after my first baby. And that was the best, to this day, the best form of therapy for me.
Yeah.
Because, and I don't know if it's this way for all runners, but maybe it's a blonde thing. I can't run and think at the same time.
Yeah. No, so, same here.
Okay. So, and again, I just assume I'm alone in that. So I would love it because I would run and I don't mean not think, like I would, it forced me to be present.
Yes.
You know, I would notice the smells and, you know, the sounds and how green things looked. And I would, you know, I obviously would think about my heart rate and how I felt like I was dying and things like that, but yeah. I couldn't think about my problems. Like I couldn't run and ruminate over all of the things that were going wrong in my life. And maybe it's because I always had music going, but I turned it off a few times and I still had the same thing. And so I think that's part of it. It's one of the only areas of my life that it stops the madness. It quiets the noise.
Yeah.
And so that kind of happened by accident. That's a good thing. Obviously, like, I think a lot of people tried, you know, dabbling with, like, alcohol and, like, trying to numb it for a while. And, of course, that helps when you're feeling good. But
yeah.
It certainly doesn't the next day. I think, I mean, this is going to sound super corny. Really good friends, like, people that truly understand that I can call, that they know. That I can just say, hey, life sucks right now. And they'll be like, hey, me too. And we don't need to fix it. We don't need to really, I mean, sometimes we dig in, sometimes we talk about it, but sometimes it's just that acknowledgement that, you know, maybe it's something in the air, maybe it's not, but like people are feeling it and I'm not alone. And sometimes that's truly all I need is to just be like, hey, sitting in the suck right now. It's not gonna stick. It's, you know, it'll go away, but right now I'm not happy. And
right.
And
that's,
I had good
that's
people
one of the
that,
most important ones is to discover that it is a thing. It's a cycle. It comes in, it stays for however long it stays, but eventually it goes away.
Yeah.
And if you can start wrapping your mind around the idea, you know, that, you know, this too shall pass. It is a thing that will help you get past the other side. You can develop a determination if you're a person who's never had determination.
Yes.
It's funny that you brought up running too. It's like I discovered that I love running, despite the fact that I'm terrible at it.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
I never feel graceful. Always feel like I'm sweating too much. I can't breathe right. Just stomping along. But it's kind of wonderful. I think when you tell people that you run, they get an image in their head of a runner. But, you know, I look at a person like me and I go, yeah, that's also a runner.
Yep.
It's running is just, you know, it's just running.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some psychological stuff where you're literally running away from your problems. You're literally leaving the crap behind. I don't know. But I never, like you said, I have a friend that runs and you know, she looks like a runner. You know what I mean? Like I never, even in my days where I would run 7 days a week because mentally I needed it, not because of exercise or anything like that. I did not look like a runner. I never had like the nice runner's legs. I didn't have any of that. And I would come home and I remember sprawling on the hardwood floor and I would text somebody and I'd be like, if you don't hear from me in an hour, come scoop up my dead body. Like I'm it's 90 degrees. I ran. I'm so out of shape and I'm literally melting into the hardwood right now.
Right.
But it was so good. It was like, I don't know if it's like a masochism thing. It was like, God, this hurts. God, this sucks. And I was like, oh, I love that. I'm going to do it again tomorrow.
No, I mean, it's caveman stuff. It's your body decides that you're running away from something. So it's going to deliver all of these endorphins, all of this dopamine, all of this great, great stuff. And you're outside, you know, or you're not. Sometimes you're indoors. But, you know, if I prefer to run outside because I like the sun. And I don't care that it's going to make me, you know, sweaty and gross and I'm going to look all weird bouncing around. But it just does something to you. I feel like there's nothing more natural than just getting out and moving. And then at the end of it, it always feels satisfying, even though the beginning of it feels like shit.
Yeah. Like being done. And it's not just that obviously there's the joy of being done.
Yeah.
But there's something like I never got discouraged about my time because I was never fast either.
Yeah, me neither.
You know, I barely broke like an 11-minute mile. It's not like I was. And I had runner friends, and they'd be like, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 8 minutes. So I'd be like, yeah, we're never running together.
Oh, you're adorable.
Because you're going to lap me, you know?
Yeah.
But there was just something about it. And it's, you know, it's come back to me at different points in my life. And there was a point where I was super overweight. Well, I, you know, still struggle with that. But it didn't matter. Like, I didn't have to be good at it. I remember going, and I was running so slow. That people could walk next to me.
Yeah.
But it felt like running. Like the illusion was there.
Yeah.
And I realized that I got the same benefits from it. You know what I mean? It didn't matter that I wasn't in good shape. It didn't matter that I wasn't moving fast. None of that mattered. Mentally, it gave me the same clarity. It gave me the same freedom, the same, I don't know that I can really even do it justice, but it's the only thing that's ever really kind of saved me and taken me out of that moment.
I completely understand that. Completely. Yeah.
Well,
I can identify with that on so many levels.
Like it honestly, like it makes me want to run right now. I'm like, oh, I forgot how good that feels. I should run, you know? And I don't know. I love it. My 13-year-old, she sees runners and she just shakes her head and she goes, why? Why does anybody do that? And I just laugh. I mean, she's in great shape. She's a cheerleader. I'm like, right. You don't understand. Like, you will later, because I hated it for years when I was younger. I tried to do it because I thought that was, I wanted the runner's body. And so I was like, well, if you run, you must get a runner's body. And that's obviously just not the case.
Yeah, that's just
and now
not the
I
case.
Just. Yeah, no. But for the mental aspects, there, I don't know that there's anything else that compares.
No, no. And that's why I do it.
It's
definitely not for, I do it for mental reasons, not for physical reasons.
Yes.
And I always
other things that do that for other people, you know,
sure.
For the people that really can't get behind running. I am certain that there are things that everybody's got their hobbies, right? Like, I'm sure there are people that tennis does that for them. But I think that running is just, and I know because I'm not a runner, although I still identify as one.
Yeah.
Like, there's still a part of me that goes, I'm a runner. You know, when I say it with that, like, yeah, I'm part of the crew. I'm part of the tribe. I'm part of the pack. I'm a runner. But like, really, if you saw me, what I do, it could not be considered actual running.
Well, I always, I tend to put things constantly in categories of punk rock. So for me, it's like, I look at other runners and they're, you know, they're Beethoven, they're virtuosos, I'm the Ramones.
Yes. Yeah. But you're still doing it, right? It's
exactly.
Music,
100%. Yeah. I'm still doing it. I'm still doing some version of this. It does come down to, you know, like you said, that sort of imposter syndrome that you get sometimes, but finding a way to categorize it in a way where you feel like you belong, it works. All of my friends are musicians and, you know, they're all brilliant. And I'm a songwriter and I've done things and I play multiple instruments, but I still feel like, you know, they're bringing out these Rembrandts and I've got crayons.
It's okay.
But
it's okay. What's
I've
that
learned
saying,
to,
the broken crayons still color?
Yeah. I've learned to embrace that and go, yeah, but I still made this.
Mm-hmm.
It's still mine. And getting to embrace those things about yourself, whatever those things may be, is actually pretty helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a combination. Like, I don't know. I know there's no cure, right? Like, for any of the mental health stuff, there's no cure. No one's ever just, you know, wipes their hands and said, well, thank God that's over. I'm done, you know, for the rest of my life. I'm just done. And so I think it's this combination of, like you said, the toolbox. And somebody said that to me not too long ago. She's like, you know, you can give the screwdriver to 10 people and it might work for 9 because they're trying to screw something in. But if you've got a nail, the screwdriver is not going to work for you.
Bingo.
You know, and so I think it's important to really figure out, like, and have a bunch of things. Because there's also, even as an individual, there are some days where something will work for me, and the next day, that same thing won't work.
Yes.
You know, so you've got to have that toolbox. You've got to have that, like, okay, so maybe it is there is a drug. Maybe there's, you know, something that helps level you out. And then for the really bad days, there's running, or there's chatting with friends, or there's journaling, or, you know, whatever works for you.
Yeah. But finding things that work and focusing on trying to find those solutions is pretty important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got to have it. And you also, one of the things I learned is you can't get complacent when you're in a good period.
Yeah.
Because it will, and it's not a negative thing. It will surface again. It will rear its ugly head, even if it's situational. That's the way life is. Life is ups and downs. And so you can't be like, well, I'm good, so I'm going to throw out everything. Like, you keep those things. You remember what makes you feel good and remember what helps and have that to go back to when that comes around again, you know?
Right. And especially if you're aware that, you know, the ups and downs are coming, if you're a person who's prone to ups and downs, really enjoy those ups. Really enjoy the hell out of them. But then when the up goes away, don't allow yourself to feel surprised or shocked or, you know, terrible. It's the terrible's going to come in and you go, yep, all right, so the up period is gone. Wasn't it wonderful? Well, I guess we'll wait until the next one shows up, and here's what I need to get through this.
Yeah. And also not blaming yourself, like recognizing that it's cyclical, right? Yeah. Like the downs are going to come again. It doesn't mean you did something wrong. It doesn't mean you screwed something up. But how boring would it be if it was up all the time? You would take for granted the ups and they wouldn't be up anymore.
Right.
They would be flatline. You know, the downs are what make you appreciate the ups. And so kind of knowing that it's coming, but also not being that doomsday of like, I know a lot of people like this, where it's like things have been good for too long. I'm just waiting. It's going to smack me in the face. It's coming. I just know it. And then they spend all of the uptime worrying about the downtime.
Yeah. Learning how to enjoy things is hard.
Yes. Yes. So it's like, but when you've done it long, I mean, you know, so my certainly not a career, my experience with this, you know, now is well over 20 years, almost 25 years. And so I figured out that these things are going to keep happening. And I think I've pretty well mastered, and I'll never be perfect at it, but I think I'm really good at, you know, accepting the ups and enjoying them. Not yeah. being fearful of the downs, but just being like, hey, you know what? Things are really good right now. They're really good right now. They may not always, but they're really good right now. And then when the downs come, you know, I used to be like, oh, I knew it was short-lived. I knew it couldn't last. And it was almost like I was accepting the down times as the norm.
Right.
You know, and I've also channeled that and changed, reframed that a little bit to like, you know what? It's just going to be a little down period. It won't last. It's cool. Like, got to have this to appreciate the ups, right? I'm just going to roll with it. And I go in what's called survival mode, where good enough is good enough. You know, yes. like when I'm struggling, yes, in my up periods, maybe my house is clean and my car is clean and I shower daily, you know, things like that.
yeah.
And in survival mode, it's like, you know, my floors are dirty, but my kids are fed
yes.
and my bills are paid and maybe I shower every other day. You know,
yeah.
I don't smell. I'm not quite as put together as normal, but it's survival mode and that's good enough. And that was one of the biggest things for me as a perfectionist is that good enough is good enough sometimes. And I'm not saying you have to live like that. I'm not saying that should be the norm, but sometimes it's okay.
Yeah.
To just get through the day, like just to lay your head down at night and go, you know what? I survived. And that's all that matters. I got through the day. I put one leg in front of the other and I didn't stay and hide under the covers, which honestly, 10 or 15 years ago, that's what I would have done.
Yeah.
So it's progress, not perfection. That's sort of my thing now.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing all the progress that you've made through all of this. And this has been awesome. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. This is great.
What did I tell you? Isn't she amazing? Man, she is going to knock people's socks off if she does more of these shows. She should do a show of her own of some kind. I could talk to her forever. Super Fucked Up with a Cape. Now that is a book title. If you want to get some more Julie in your life, and I know that you do, you can find Julie at her website, GenesisConsultingCorp.com. I recommend you go check it out and see what's going on there. As for me, you can catch me in a storytelling show called The Queen City Companion. It's a bunch of fake stories from real storytellers at the Mutiny Information Cafe in downtown Denver at 8 p.m. this Thursday, October 4th. And until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.